This is a tennis player. I bet you knew that. There are two young individuals kneeling down, squatting over there to the left side of the player. What are these two people called? And thank you for playing. They're called ball kids. There's another one. And they're individuals who've actually gone through a training process, learning information regarding the definitions of playing tennis and what the court is and the parts of the court and the lines and rules and all kinds of things like this. I'll read from the 2019 BNP Paribas Open Ball Kid Training Manual, which you see the front page of it there. It says, ball kids are a very important part of any tennis tournament. Ball kids keep the match moving, and the players rely on them to hustle to keep the pace going. The basic responsibility of a ball kid is to retrieve balls that land outside the court or in the net and to send them back to the other ball kids who are tossing balls to the player who is serving. They also hand out towels to the players between points, and they have other responsibilities, which keeps the game flowing smoothly. It says all candidates will have to study hard and complete some rigorous training. They have to give up time, and they sacrifice in order to go through this training. It's a volunteer situation. But the ball kids are rarely noticed, but their work is crucial to keeping the game flowing smoothly. They are united with the tennis players. That is, they have a common purpose. They work together in unity with the players. Being united is defined as joined together for a common purpose. And unity is defined as the state of being united or joined as a whole, or the state of forming a complete and pleasing whole. In Ephesians 4, verses 1 through 3, that was just read a moment ago, Paul said, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. Then verse 7 says, to each one of us, grace has been given as Christ apportioned it. Then in verse 16, we're told that from Christ, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its share or its work. Notice that the whole body is held together, that the body works in unity, that the body grows and builds itself up because each part does its share, because each part does its work. The church has the equivalent of ball kids. The church has members who don't stand out. They do things quietly in the background, so to speak. Like every local church, this church is made up of various members, all of whom have a part to play. Every single one of us has a part to play in working together for a common purpose. Whenever any of the members don't do their part, the unity of the church suffers and the growth of the church suffers. The question I want to encourage each one of us to ask ourselves is this: what is my share? What is my work? What is my part? What am I doing to contribute to the building up, the strengthening, and the unity of this church? And I'm not talking about what we should do for our own personal growth, though that should contribute to the unity and the growth of the church. And I'm not implying that anybody in this congregation is not doing their part. I'm not implying that anybody in this congregation is doing nothing. I'm aware that there are plenty of members here who do things outside of services. They serve others and they do work in the kingdom that most individuals will never know about. Still, I'm encouraging each one of us to ask ourselves, am I doing my part? Am I doing my share to cause unity and growth in this church? It doesn't have to be something big in the way that we often think. The question is, does it contribute to the unity and the growth of this church? Is it something that meets the definition of joining together for a common purpose? There are many important things, many vital things in life which are often seen as insignificant and inconsequential. In Acts chapter 10, we're told, Peter, in fact, tells us that the Lord himself went around doing good. I don't know about you, but that statement sounds so anticlimactic to me. You think of all the things Jesus did, the popularity, the miracles, the teachings, all the things he did and accomplished in that sense, and it's broadly, categorically stated as he went around doing good. But it sounds so insignificant, so inconsequential when you compare that to what he really did. But the Lord is pleased when we go around doing good. The Lord is pleased with small acts of kindness. Doing little things to help others is not insignificant. Matthew 10, verse 42, Jesus said, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is my disciple, truly I tell you, that person will certainly not lose their reward. And we're familiar with the text in Matthew 25, where Jesus anticipates the judgment day. And in verses 34 through 40, he addresses the significance of seemingly small acts. He says, the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. And then we're told the righteous will ask, when did we do these things? Verse 40 says, the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. We are gravely mistaken when we downplay someone's contribution to a work because it is small. Small doesn't always mean insignificant or inconsequential. You remember the feeding of the 5,000. A huge crowd, we're told. There's already the appeal to us. Huge, big. A huge crowd kept following Jesus wherever he went because they saw his miraculous signs as he healed the sick. And Jesus climbed a hill and sat down with his disciples around him. It was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration. Jesus soon saw a huge crowd of people coming to look for him. Turning to Philip, he asked, where can we buy bread to feed all these people? He was testing Philip, for he already knew what he was going to do. Philip replied, even if we worked for months, we wouldn't have enough money to feed them. Then Andrew, Simon's brother, spoke up. There's a young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what good is that with this huge crowd? And there it is. The young boy's contribution was considered useless. when looking at the scope of the problem. It was insignificant. It was inconsequential. But don't underestimate what the Lord can do with a small effort. And notice the unity here, with each part doing its share. Philip speaks up and asks a question. This seems to prompt Andrew to speak up and point out the boy. And then the young boy simply shared what he had. You know, without those three things, especially the last one there, you wouldn't have had a feeding of the 5,000, at least not in the way that we know of it. Each part did its share. In Matthew 13, verses 31 and 32, we're told that Jesus spoke a parable saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." Many things which have small beginnings end up growing into something huge or yielding tremendous results. We often underestimate the opportunities to tell others because we may think it won't make any difference. We sometimes pass by opportunities to talk to someone about the Bible, to ask a Bible-related question, or to make a Bible comment in general conversations with others. You never know what it might produce. In 1 Corinthians 3, regarding his efforts in the Lord's kingdom, Paul said that he had planted, and he said that Apollos had watered, but it was God who gave the increase. I don't know about you, but planting seeds doesn't say, you know, that doesn't require a lot of training, I don't think. And it just doesn't sound like that significant of a thing to do. Plant some seeds here, and somebody comes along and waters. That just doesn't sound too impressive to me. But how significant is that, as Paul describes it? A simple question asked of the Ethiopian eunuch: "Do you understand what you are reading?" And only God knows the impact that this one man ended up having on others. When you open a door to talk to someone about the gospel, when you take advantage of an opportunity to discuss spiritual things with an unbeliever, you have no idea what kind of change you might make in their life. And then what kind of change they may make in the lives of countless others. If we take care of the little things, God will take care of the big things. We often underestimate the power of words. Words are such small, seemingly insignificant things. Some people act as if words really don't matter. What you say to others just doesn't really matter. But words can be used for great benefit. They can be used for great harm. Words of encouragement have contributed to the successes in the lives of many people. And words have brought others to the depths of despair, even to the point of taking their own life. The first 12 verses of James chapter 3 impresses upon us the importance of the tongue, of the potential impact of our words, especially regarding their power to destroy and bring harm. He says in James 3, beginning in verse 1, "Not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. Anyone who is never at fault in what they say is perfect, able to keep their whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal, or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. Mark Twain once said, I can live for 2 months on a good compliment. In Proverbs 15, verses 1 and 4, the writer talks about the power of words. He says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Verse 4, the soothing tongue is a tree of life, but a perverse tongue crushes the spirit. We need to be aware of the power of words to do good, and we need to be cautious regarding the power of words to do evil and to bring harm. And we often underestimate that power. We also often underestimate just the power of little things in general. A $3.5 million Lamborghini. Yes, you read that right. $3.6 million Lamborghini is absolutely no use without the little key fob. A massive piece of electrical equipment is entirely worthless without the little plug at the end of the cord. And you could go on. James talked about the ship and the rudder and the horse and the bit in its mouth. You know, the deadliest creature in the world is not a tiger or a bear or some other huge beast. Do you know what the deadliest creature in the world is? A mosquito. I saw anywhere from 700,000 to 1 million to 3 million people a year that die. It's the internet, so I guess you have to believe that. But that sounds just astronomical to me. Hard to believe. In the end, it's often the little things that determine whether or not we fail or succeed. The Christian writer E.G. White said, it is one of Satan's most successful devices to lead men to the commission of little sins, to blind the mind to the danger of little indulgences, little digressions from the plainly stated requirements of God. Many who would shrink with horror from some great transgression are led to look upon sin in little matters as of trifling consequence. But those little sins eat out the life of godliness in the soul. Every member of the church has a function to fulfill. Romans 12, verses 3 through 8, Paul says, for by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith that God has distributed to each of you. For just as each of us has one body with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, so in Christ we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. We have different gifts according to the grace given to each of us. If your gift is prophesying, then prophesy in accordance with your faith. If it is serving, then serve. If it is teaching, then teach. If it is to encourage, then give encouragement. If it is giving, then give generously. If it is to lead, do it diligently. If it is to show mercy, do it cheerfully. Are those some of those items there things that you would put on a list if somebody said, what can you do? Would you think, I can show mercy? Would you think, I can be an encouragement? Some of the others we would readily recognize, but every single member of this congregation can do something that contributes to the unity and the growth of this church. There's nothing in this list. And then Paul goes on in verse 9 and following, and he talks about loving, and love must be sincere, and we're to hate what is evil and cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. Don't be lacking in zeal. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Bless those who persecute you. Verse 14. Fix them something to eat. Be good to them. Give them something to drink and so forth. There's nothing here about preaching to multitudes. There's nothing here about works of grandeur. These are small acts of kindness. These are small acts of doing good. Every member of the church is important. Each member of this church has a part to play as we are joined together for a common purpose. This being joined together is really made clear in 1 Corinthians 12, verses 12 through 22. Paul says, just as one body has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. For we were all baptized by one Spirit so as to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free. And we were all given the one Spirit to drink. Even so, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. Now, if the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason stop being part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, think about that for a moment. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But in fact, God has placed the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weak are indispensable. What are you doing with the opportunities that are available to you? What could you be doing with the abilities you have and with the opportunities you have? What are you doing that's contributing to the unity and the growth of this church? These are not accusations. These are just questions to cause all of us, each one of us, myself included, to rethink. Is there something I could be doing that I should be doing that would be helpful for me to do that I'm really just not doing? If the rest of this congregation, this sounds really negative. I'll say it anyway because I prefaced it that way, so it won't come across as bad, I guess. If the rest of this congregation was doing only what you're doing, how strong would this congregation be? How much work would be occurring? How much growth would be taking place? How much would they be contributing to the unity of this church? You know, some may think that unity simply means that we're all supposed to just get along. That's unity, right? As long as we're not fussing and fighting, we're all unified, right? In a tennis match, a ball kid is not helping create unity by merely being quiet and peacefully sitting on the sidelines without causing any problems. He or she helps create unity by doing his or her part, by doing his or her share of the work, and therefore making the game run more smoothly. He says, I'm not yelling, I'm not throwing things at people, I'm not being a distraction, but you're not doing anything. There are things you need to be doing. And since you're not doing them, you're creating disunity. Because it's frustrating because everybody's depending on you to do your share. It's not enough to say I didn't do anything that actively and directly caused a problem. I didn't throw an extra ball into the mix in the midst of a volley. Someone could say that they hadn't caused a problem if they didn't even attend. If that's all you had to do is be at peace and not create any friction. I didn't create any either. I wasn't even within 100 miles of the tennis match. That doesn't mean I'm participating in something and creating unity. The question is, what did you do that actively contributed to the unity and the common purpose of the game? You know, due to an accident, if someone's arms merely hang quietly and peacefully at their sides, would you say that their hands and arms were joining together with their body for a common purpose? That's the definition of united, if you recall. Just because their arms and hands don't actively cause problems and don't attack the rest of their body, they're working in unity? No, they're not working in unity. They're not contributing anything. Unity does not just mean the absence of conflict. Unity is not achieved by benign neglect. Again, unity is the state of being united, and being united is being joined together for a common purpose. Unity is seen in unified action, activity with a common purpose. Ephesians 4:16 again. From Christ, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its share, or as each part does its work. There is no unity unless each part is doing its share. There's a lot of work that's necessarily done behind the scenes. That's true in anything. There are lots of little things that we can do as we work for the unity of the church. We can welcome people as they come in. We can provide a ride for people who can't drive or somehow can't find another way there. We can offer to watch someone's children while they go out to dinner. We can try to set up a Bible study with someone. And if you don't feel comfortable leading the study, you can ask me or one of the other men to do so. You can try to sign someone up for a correspondence course. Visit people in the hospital. Visit members who are unable to attend. Invite other families over for lunch on a Friday night or a Saturday, Sunday afternoon, or whatever afternoon or night. It doesn't have to be Friday or Sunday. Call and check on those who are sick. The list could go on. One legend, and there are several legends regarding this, but one legend says that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 began when a cow in Mrs. Leary's barn twitched its leg and kicked over a lamp. The lamp broke and caught some hay on fire, and soon the whole barn was up in flames, and the fire spread to the city where hundreds of people died and millions of dollars of damage occurred, all because a cow's leg twitched. In a tennis tournament, as we talked about earlier, you rarely see the ball kids. Most people might not even be aware of their presence. Yet a tennis tournament would be cumbersome and sometimes frustrating without the ball kids there, silently and invisibly doing their part. Just as a body is considered to be handicapped when certain members of that body do not function properly, a church is handicapped when members of that body do not do their part. The church cannot grow and perform to its full potential when some of the members are contributing nothing to make the church stronger. The church will never experience the unity that the Lord desires when some of the members do not do their part, do not do their share. Paul said, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. From Christ, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its share. Let us make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. And let us contribute to the unity of the church and the support and growth and the building up of the church by each one of us doing our share.